Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post, is in the thick of this country's debate over power and money and the health of the nation. In a new book, she makes it very clear where she stands. America's middle class is collapsing, she says. And if it goes, she says, the mighty USA will go third world. This hour on Point, Arianna Huffington on what's gone wrong and how to fix it. You can join the conversation. Do you share the fear? Is it overblown? Are you living it? Do you share the hope of turning this country around? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Arianna Huffington joins me now in the studio, co-founder and editor of the Huffington Post, one of the most popular news and comment sites on the web. A Greek-born immigrant to the United States, in the 1990s, she emerged as a distinctive conservative voice, a supporter of Newt Gingrich and all that. In 2003, she ran as an independent candidate for California governor. Today, she is one of the most prominent progressive voices in the country. Her new book is Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. Arianna Huffington, welcome to On Point. Welcome back, I should
say. Thank you. It's great to be in studio with you.
Yes, it is. At last. Third world? Is this hyperbole? Are you kidding? Are you serious? What? Third world?
I know it's a very jarring phrase because it doesn't match at all our image of this great, noble, generous nation. But in fact, I feel a little bit like Cassandra. I feel that I have to sound the warning. And the reason why I want to do it now is because there is now still time to turn things around, time to prevent becoming a third world country. But if we don't course correct, that's the trajectory we're on.
Isn't our per capita GDP still number one?
The point I'm making is that the essence of the American dream is upward mobility. And the foundation of our prosperity and our democracy is the middle class. And the middle class is crumbling. We now have more and more people becoming the formerly middle class or the new poor, whatever term you want to use, with 26 million people unemployed or underemployed, with 3 million homes foreclosed last year and about as many expected to be foreclosed this year. You know, bankruptcies, credit card defaults, all the things that we read about every day. If you actually put flesh and blood on this data, you see something really, really tragic happening. And then we have the anecdotal evidence. We all have friends mm-hmm. who have children graduating from college and they can't get jobs. We have friends in their 40s and 50s who lost jobs and they cannot get another job. And so as well as all the blue-collar workers or all those employed in Detroit, in manufacturing industries that have disappeared, we have people who are lawyers, accountants, who cannot get other jobs. So there's something happening that we are not really paying enough attention to.
Politicians have always called out to the middle class because that's where the votes were. The crusading in this country long went on around poverty. I mean, the middle class, you appealed to, but the crusading went, we must lift the poor. But now you're saying the middle class itself is where the attention
exactly.
needs to be.
And of course, poverty, since the census is going to come up with new numbers this week.
Mm-hmm.
That poverty has gone up to 15%. These are numbers that we're dealing with in the 1960s when we launched the war on poverty. So the social safety net is so frayed, and now we have more and more middle class people going on food stamps and public assistance.
I'm looking at numbers here from the CIA, no less, saying that income distribution in the United States is now more unequal than in Guyana, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. The headline is income more unequal in the U.S. than in parts of Latin America. Why is the middle class the key issue when you talk about third world status? I mean, isn't it general poverty? Why do you focus on the middle class?
The reason why it's central is because there have always been poor in this country. And I'm not in any way cavalier about it. I mean, we always should have done more, including in the Clinton years when we were prosperous and could have afforded to do more. But the middle class is what has made us a first world nation in the sense that we didn't have what you see in Mexico or Brazil, which is the rich and everyone else.
You write about think Mexico or Brazil, where the wealthy live behind fortified gates with machine gun toting guards protecting their kids from kidnapping.
Exactly. Because what happens is that the middle class has always been aspirational in this country as opposed to vengeful and envious. And because there's always been the assumption that, you know, I can work hard and play by the rules and I can be rich too. That's been the American dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people have not even objected to tax cuts for the rich. It somehow felt, okay,
everybody's in the game.
Everybody's in the game. And that's the key. Right now, people are feeling, and we see that in the anger, we see that in the Tea Party movement, we are not all in the same game. There are two games going on. I like actually the way you put it. That's exactly what's going on. There is the Wall Street game, and you get bailed out if you fail, and you do very well, and then there is the game for the rest of us.
So you don't portray this, though, as just an accident. I mean, it's right in your title, betraying the American dream. That's active. This didn't happen just willy-nilly.
No, no, no. It was not an accident. It's not as if the middle class lost its mojo suddenly. This was the result of special interests buying public policy, tricks and traps in mortgage contracts, in credit card contracts. Now, let me be very clear, Tom. I'm not saying that people don't have personal responsibility. I mean, people bought into the idea that somehow there was a shortcut to the good life, that you could have a sort of no down payment, no proof of income ticket to the good life. Now, these are the sort of the drug peddlers peddling that, whether they were payday loans or mortgages without any proof of income or credit card offers with teaser interest rates that quickly skyrocketed 29-30%.
Right.
But these were like, if you want, the street corner drug pushers.
And people borrowed in part because their incomes weren't going anywhere.
Yes, well, that's the other thing, that you had now two income families who could not make ends meet, and they were borrowing to sustain their lifestyles. They were borrowing on their credit cards. You know, Homer Simpson, he couldn't do it today. You know,
that's a pretty decent house, that split level on the nice street.
Split house, right, the wife not working,
right,
all
right.
These
Forget
kids. You know, absolutely. Do you know anybody like that who can do that now?
Third world doesn't just mean poverty. You're saying it's the absence of a middle class. Why, politically, is a strong middle class so important? Why has it been important for this country?
Well, it's been so important because that's what has been the foundation of our democratic stability. And we see what happens now when anger spreads, when you have a sense of fundamental unfairness. You know, I think the Tea Party movement is a fascinating phenomenon because at the heart of it is that sense of unfairness, that sense that we are not all in the same game. And sure, they blame government. But, you know, for the first time, we have something that we can all really blame government for, and that's the bailout of Wall Street, which was really the product of all establishments coming together, you know, Republican, Democratic political establishments.
And led by George W. Bush.
Led by George W. Bush, but with Obama and the Democratic
following on.
And they bailed out Wall Street without any conditions, without any strings attached. It is really extraordinary because it's really so against the capitalist system. I mean, I have very conservative capitalist friends who are appalled by what happened.
So a lot of people are in trouble economically and a lot of people are angry. Why is the main anger Tea Party anger? Their solution is very different from yours, Arianna Huffington.
Yes, absolutely. And anytime you have a lot of anger and a lot of economic anxiety, including from people who have not yet suffered themselves. A lot of the people in the Tea Party movement have not lost jobs or homes, but they are worried. And so they can be very easily demagogued. And that's what's happening now. We have demagogues appealing to that anger and making people believe, as demagogues have done throughout history, that there are scapegoats. And the scapegoat is big government. The scapegoat is Barack Obama, who, as we all know, is Muslim, right? And all the things all the things that people believe. You had Newt Gingrich, like, talking about his Kenyan anti-colonial view. You know,
just over the weekend.
You have, like, absolutely ludicrous statements being believed by substantial numbers in this country.
But maybe, I mean, they might look at you and say, you're a demagogue, and they'd say, you know, what's more, this is, you're talking socialism, Ariana.
No, not at all. I'm not talking socialism. In fact, my chapter of solutions is totally beyond left and right, because as well as asking government to do certain things, primarily bring a real sense of urgency to the creation of jobs, with solutions across the political spectrum. I'm advocating everything from a payroll tax holiday to big infrastructure programs. But beyond that, I think the most important thing I'm saying in the book is that we can't just wait on the sidelines for government to do something. We need to come together in our own communities and rebuild our lives, rebuild civil society, help each other. And I give specific steps of what we need to do.
That's kind of a feel-good sound, but you're talking tough here. You're saying this doesn't happen. Once you get into a wealth and power imbalance like this, it doesn't get fixed easily. You remind us of the civil rights era and people facing down fire hoses. The suggestion that may have to happen again.
Well, what I'm saying is that we are now into what I'm calling HOP 2.0.
Hope 2.0.
Hope 2.0. Okay. You know, HOP was, you know, let's elect Barack Obama, and then he's going to make everything better, and we can just sit on our couches and watch the show. Well, that's not going to happen. This is about democracy is not a spectator sport. So we need to be involved. We need to be involved pressuring government to do what we consider the right thing, but we also need to be involved in our communities. And I give a lot of examples that are not at all feel good. They're very real. There are people out of work who, instead of just moaning and feeling like victims, are organizing. They're self-organizing to help each other, like Seth Reams in Portland, Oregon, creating a site called wehavetimetohelp.org. Because if there is one thing you have if you're out of work, it's time to help.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a big progressive voice, Ariana Huffington. She says the American middle class is in danger of collapse. Her new book is Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. Barack Obama talking about helping middle class families just Friday in a press conference.
Instead of tax cuts for millionaires, we believe in cutting taxes for middle class families and small business owners. We've done that. Instead of letting corporations play by their own rules, we believe in making sure that businesses treat workers well and consumers friendly and play by the same rules as everyone else.
Play by the same rules, standing up for the middle class, says the president, but you are pretty tough on this administration.
Yes, Ariana. Because we're clearly not playing by the same rules. Just look at what happened with Wall Street. I mean, we the taxpayers, mm-hmm. gave $180 billion to AIG.
One firm,
mm-hmm. right? Which in turn turned around and gave, let's say, to Goldman Sachs $13 billion. And that was 100 cents to the dollar. I mean, nobody would negotiate like that if it was their own money.
When Lehman was out and things were falling down.
And that was the time when there had to have been real conditions, like telling them, okay, we'll bail you out, but here's what you have to do. Number one, you need to turn around and lend so that we can create jobs. Instead, they cut lending to the tune of $100 billion. Number two, the end of Too Big to Fail, which still, even after the financial reform bill, we have not ended. No bonuses, you know, no clawbacks. You know, you made all this money on the backs of middle-class families. You got to give some of it back. You got to really work with the families to keep them in their homes. Banks are fighting loan modifications. They fought the cramdown amendment, which would have kept over 1 million families in their homes. That is absolute negligence. I mean, the Obama administration, the Democratic Congress, has a real responsibility for allowing that to happen, for allowing the Treasury to get away with a lousy anti-foreclosure program, which has meant that millions of families are out of their homes. I don't know, Tom, but I have two daughters. Mm-hmm. And the idea of a family having to leave their home with children to move into a motel, to moving to a homeless shelter is devastating.
When AIG and the gang are sort of bailed out to fare thee well.
Exactly.
But, you know, Barack Obama had hope and change as his big theme. He had huge support in the general election. What grade do you give him now? And if it's not up to what you wish, why not? Why not? What happened here?
Well, what happened is that, first of all, the status quo is really hard to change. You know, it's one thing to campaign against the status quo. It's another thing to become part of it and try and change it from the inside.
But come on, change was the single word on his banner.
Listen, trust me, I'm not justifying it. I'm trying to explain what happened. The single most important thing that happened is that he brought in the wrong people to run economic policy. He brought in Larry Summers, who was one of the architects of Glass-Steagall, which began this... which basically ended these protections that had been put in place with the New Deal. Mm. He brought in Tim Geithner. These are smart people, but they are completely Wall Street-centric people. And they completely underestimated the economic crisis. They remember, they kept talking about unemployment being a lagging indicator
mm-hmm. it'll
and
come, it'll
down
come.
To 8%.
But the president chose them. What about the chief executive himself here? What about his instincts?
Absolutely.
And they may take a drubbing in the midterms. I don't know. They may.
They will take a drubbing.
But does Barack Obama have the inclination to do it differently?
Well,
somehow?
That's really the key. It's all about, is he going to be able to course correct? He's changed the rhetoric. Last week, you know, it was a very different Barack Obama on the stump. But changing the rhetoric is not really enough. You know, he really needs to change policies. He needs to change personnel. When you're the chief executive of the United States, personnel is policy. If you put the wrong people in control, and he did that, you're in trouble.
Arianna Huffington is with us. Her new book is Third World America. We'll go to calls in just a moment, but lots of questions and comments coming in already. Here's one from Facebook, Arianna, from Darian. It says, why does she, you, demonize freedom-loving Americans? What's so wrong about the desire to be free of big government, free of the penalties incurred by so much intrusion into our lives?
I don't think I said anything that demonized free-loving Americans. I said, on the contrary, that I can understand why people can more easily now see government as the problem, because it was government that instituted these massive bailouts, which were basically taking taxpayer money to bail out institutions that had taken excessive risk and which, under the capitalist rule, should have been allowed to fail.
That's backward. But look forward. Republicans are saying, let's get government out of the way and, you know, somehow this economy will improve. It'll generate what capitalism generates.
Well, that's not going to happen, because basically we don't have the demand now. Consumer demand is down dramatically, because ironically, when we need the demand, people are now saving. People are worried. People are not spending what they used to spend, and they don't have their houses to use as ATM machines. So what we learned from the New Deal is that at times when private demand is not strong, you need government to generate demand, like with infrastructure projects. And what's happening, Tom, in California, what we're seeing now with the fire in California, is that we are running out of time in terms of fixing our infrastructure.
The gas explosion,
yes,
natural
gas. I have an entire section on the book that I call America the Dilapidated, because this is all over the country. We have problems with the natural gas lines, electric lines, dams. It's everywhere.
Travel these days internationally, it used to be you'd feel pride at, boy, it's better at home. These days, my gosh, it's a lot more shiny and gleaming very often elsewhere.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is an aging infrastructure that we have not really invested the resources to fix. And what are we doing instead? We are spending this year $161 billion fighting the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is really what declining empires do. They fight wars that are not necessary to their national security and that they cannot win. We're never going to win in Afghanistan. We're just propping up a corrupt regime at the expense of our soldiers' lives and at the expense of embattled Americans here at home who need their resources.
Arianna Huffington is with us. Let's go to our callers, Jamie in Nashville. Jamie, you're on the air with Arianna Huffington.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Arianna. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hi.
I would like to say, first off, I have not read your book, but I am going to go out and buy it. I think you are a voice that is sorely needed. I would just like to make the comment that you're talking about the disappearing middle class. My wife and I are victims of that. We had lived, I guess, what some would classify as a comfortable life. I have a small business, but we pay our bills on time, always have paid our bills, yet our credit card rates by the banks who received bailout funds to the tune of 0% or low percent, now charging us anywhere from 20% to 29.9%. My parents, equally the same way, a comfortable life. My dad had a small business, employed 6 people. He's now had to file bankruptcy because he's caught in the donut hole. He has COPD. His medications went from $700 a month to almost $7,000.
Jamie, when Ariana says third world, Jamie, when she says third world, does that sound like exaggeration to you or like a real risk?
It is not an exaggeration in the least. I think I differ a little bit with Ariana that we are not on track to become a third world country. I think we're already there. And for the life of me, I cannot figure out why people are not in the streets. You referenced a while ago, Tom, about maybe we'd be going back to the days of fire hoses and the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that not happening now? How have they been so successful in portraying helping your fellow man as the mark of socialism or evil? And we live in the South, and this is a very religious part of the country. How are these people able to differentiate their spiritual beliefs from their practical beliefs?
Well, Jamie, there's a lot of Tea Partiers in the street. Maybe that's the reaction right there. Maybe that's Americans standing up.
You know what?
But they're
really
reacting the wrong way, Tom. They're reacting the wrong way. I mean, they're protesting against big government. We are the government. We the people.
It you know, Jamie, I you know what you're saying is really moving and powerful, and I would love you to write about it on the Huffington Post. We have launched a section called Third World America. If you go to huffingtonpost.com/thirdworldamerica, we are actually inviting people like you who've experienced what's happening to write about it, to share stories, and to help each other take steps, because the one thing we cannot do is we cannot move into despair. And the greatest antidote to despair is action. So on that site, you know, we are doing a lot of things by bringing people together, by offering resources, by sharing stories, by even crowdsourcing my book tour. So, you know, you could let me know where you are, and maybe I'll come there and talk to the people like you who are going through this experience.
Jamie, thanks for your call. I mean, you do get into the tough stuff here. It almost sounds like you're calling, you know, for the kind of confrontations. You go back to 1965, March, Martin Luther King, LBJ's in power. Martin Luther King can't get the National Voting Rights Act through, and pretty soon we've got the confrontation, the Bloody Sunday confrontation in Selma, tear gas and truncheons. Is that what you're calling for now? Is the Tea Party demonstrations essentially a version of what you're asking for or not?
No. What I'm saying in that section is that one of the most powerful moments in American history was in March 65 when Martin Luther King met with Lyndon Johnson and asked for the Voting Rights Act. And Lyndon Johnson said, we don't have the votes, which is what politicians always say when there are big challenges to the status quo.
We've heard it a lot in the last year and a half.
We've heard it a lot, mm-hmm. Exactly. So then came the Selma March. And a few months later, we had the Voting Rights Act. I don't believe that history ever repeats itself in exactly the same ways. There are different ways now to organize, and a lot of it is happening online. If you go online, I spend a lot of time both traveling the country and going to an amazing social media sites like howigotlaidoff.com, recessionwire.com, wehavetimetohelp.com. People are organizing, sharing stories, helping each other. That's what we're also doing on the Huffington Post.
But the pressure, a lot of it you're describing in this book, is not just online. It's in the streets. And I'm just struck that there are people in the streets now. They just don't happen to be behind your parade.
Well, there are people in the streets, and what's happening, let's say, with the Glenn Beck rally, which was not a political rally, it's also what Glenn Beck said, let's also look at what are the values that we have. Now, I may disagree with what Glenn Beck is saying, and of course, a lot of what he's saying is completely demagoguery, but the point is that people are really digging deeper and trying to see what is it that they really value in their lives. And if we can take that moment and channel it in positive direction instead of taking it and channeling it in a way that divides us, that turns us against immigrants, that turns us against each other, then it will actually be not just going back to where we were, but improving where we are.
John in Des Moines, Iowa. You're on with Ariana Huffington, John.
Hi, Tom. Great subject. I am a third generation here in the heartland, Des Moines, Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was a union carpenter, worked all through the Great Depression, provided a good living for his family. My father worked for the telephone company, was an installer, and back when it was the phone company, provided a good living for his family. That is not the situation these days. People don't stay at jobs for 30 years anymore. They don't have the benefits they used to have. I don't understand why poor people vote for Republicans.
But what's the answer, John, then? If that's some people's answer, what's your answer?
Well, my answer is unions. Why the young people, the technology people, the computer people, why they don't organize and establish unions.
And if they did and we could get $20 an hour in this country, what would you do then about competition from China where it's $2 an hour?
Well, we have to pass the proper laws to protect our workers and to protect our goods and not to sell cheap. If there was a foundation for family income in this country, a minimum living wage, we wouldn't have these problems. I would even go so far as to say a two-tiered minimum wage, where maybe young people 16 to 22 or 25 would perhaps have a lower minimum wage. But if you're out there trying to provide for a family, provide a household, you need to have a foundation.
And it's not there in many cases.
When we have 11 million illegal aliens out there taking jobs that supposedly Americans won't take, it's not about the job. It's about the pay.
John, I appreciate your call from Des Moines. Ariana, where's the foundation, John says? And it sounds to me as though he wants to, I don't know, close some borders, and maybe both to trade and maybe to immigration. While we look at that, here's another. This is from the website. Huffington bears some responsibility for the plight of the middle class, it says, since she was and still is a big supporter of NAFTA and free trade. What about trade and immigration when it comes to American prosperity?
Well, actually, I have written a lot of negative things about NAFTA, because I think what it has ended up becoming is a kind of race to the bottom, where the job conditions in other countries have allowed employers here not to offer the kind of benefits and the kind of job security that John was talking about.
Does that mean you're ready to dump free trade?
No, I'm saying that we need to really look at what are the conditions that that employers are able to provide, and also to look at the subsidies. Right now we're providing subsidies to powerful interests like the sugar lobby, like big farmers. And as a result, look at what's happening, the consequences, the food we eat, the pharmaceutical companies that have such huge power that they managed to get all their advantages early on in negotiating for the health care bill, etc.
But in a globalized economy, can we have what our Des Moines caller is desperate for, a minimum living wage, a foundation for American families, or is that pie in the sky now?
We have to insist that we do that.
How do you do it? By insisting. Don't you have to compete and win?
Yeah, but you know, you don't compete by basically using sweatshop conditions to pay your workforce substandard wages. I mean, that's not what America is about. That's why I go back to what America is about.
Do we still have the leverage to insist and have the rest of the world say, okay?
No, it's not about what the rest of the world says. It's what we are doing right here. You see, America is about innovation. You see, the iPad may be manufactured in China, but it was dreamed up in America. So we need to actually spur innovation, and that's where tax credit policy is a great way to go, and also just encouraging new businesses, because that's where most of the job growth is.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. She said the American middle class is in danger of collapse. Her book title says it all, I guess, Third World America. Arianna, here's interesting sort of back-to-back comments on the web with two different reactions. Here's from Nancy. She says that Arianna's repeating the message of Obama, redistribution of wealth, restoring the middle class to good health. However, she says, instead of aligning and promoting that agenda, you're talking negatively on all levels, using scare tactics and fear as the base of the argument. Here's Eric on the other side. He says, I'd like to suggest that progressives become much less polite. Call Cheney a coward in a trailer. Call Limbaugh a drugged-out plutocrat. The left is so damn polite, he writes, the conservatives have their shills rabble-roused. Call a lie, time to get tough. One saying, you know, you're fear-mongering. The other says, get tougher.
Well, first of all, fear-mongering is the worst thing anybody can be doing. And there's the exact opposite in the book. The book is focusing on the solutions, on what we can do to prevent a third world America future. In terms of calling Cheney and Limbaugh names, nobody should waste an ounce of energy on that. All our energy should go on what are we doing now?
Are you sure? I heard Glenn Beck call Michelle Obama evil yesterday. Glenn Beck's pretty popular right now.
You know, with a small segment of the population. You know, we have over 300 million people in this country. So the question is, are we going to appeal to people's better angels or are we going to appeal to our baser instincts? We all are a combination of both. And who we appeal to and what comes to the forefront is going to determine our future.
Let's hear from Sophie in Providence, Rhode Island. Sophie, you're on the air with Arianna Huffington.
Yes, Arianna, it's very nice to be on the air and to talk about the subject that is, I think, to my knowledge, is an unbelievable fact that nobody is today going into the streets and protesting. I think that in Europe, most of the people will not take 1 second of what's been going on with the bailout and the amount of money that the people are spending to bail out all these companies, banks, etc.
In the streets. Is that what you want?
No.
Is that
I'm
what
not,
it takes? I mean,
I'm
you're saying,
saying
you've got to, they say there's not the votes, and you're saying you've got to bring on the heat somehow then.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that it's about the streets. Because just because it was about the streets mm-hmm. in the 60s, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean it's about the streets now.
Mm-hmm.
I think what it is about now is both calling on government in all the ways we know how to do the right thing, and I have a whole list of prescriptions which do start actually with public financing of our elections, because if we don't do that, our public policy will continue to be basically bought by the highest bidder.
There's and that's the Banana Republic path.
Exactly, that's the Banana Republic path, and it's happening all the time. I mean, we've seen it with the mining disaster, with BP disaster, with Wall Street disaster. These were all functions of a deregulated system. Even when you had regulators mm-hmm. available, they had been captured mm-hmm. by the existing system. Mm-hmm. And so we had these three major disasters, just the consequence of which we're still living with. So beyond that, it's really recognizing what we can do in our own communities, ranging from what wealthy people can do in their communities. I profile Susie Buffett, for example, Warren Buffett's daughter, who has taken her own foundation and she's spending everything in Omaha. She's treating Omaha like a family.
Okay.
You know, if they're going to close down the libraries because they don't have the money, she gives them a grant. If there's teenage pregnancy going up, she finds some solutions to it.
That sounds a little bit third world, too, though. I mean, hometown is going to be bailed out by the local haciendero, by the local
aristocracy.
Yeah, but what
I'm saying is that in this at this moment, while we're trying to turn things around, we need to throw everything at the problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that includes philanthropy, and that includes
her dad and Bill Gates giving away what, half their fortunes or more?
And that includes, I mean, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yep.
Wealthy people should give away whatever they're not going to spend. I mean, there's the concept of tithing. There are people who, deep spiritual beliefs, who remember that it you know, the Bible tells us we shall be judged by what you do for the least among us. So this is the moment to throw everything at the problems we're having.
Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Tom in Omaha, you're on the air with Arianna Huffington.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
Well.
Good. There's been a lot of discussion this morning about why is it that these type of things are being able to be put over on us and so forth. I think that people more and more understand how the brain works and all these different things. And I think the conservatives have had a plan since the 60s on how to gradually move us in that direction. They're very patient. They look at building their power up from the local level and so on and so forth, so that when we go to appeal something, we've got local judges and stuff that support them. But I learned a long time in business not to look at what people say, but to look at what people do. And if we look today at the people in the world used to want to come to America to improve their lives. Now, people who have done that are looking to go back to their home countries because they see them as a better situation. And that's as good an explanation of, are we becoming a third world country as one could find.
Yeah, no
well,
kidding.
You know, it's kind of interesting because in the preface to my book, mm-hmm. I write about how about my own journey, you know, as an immigrant, because I was brought up in Athens, and mm-hmm. I remember walking to school every day and passing a statue of President Truman, who was kind of a symbol because of the Marshall Plan mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. America, the generous kind of magnificent nation. Mm-hmm. And my family had friends who had emigrated to America in pursuit of a better life. These were the terms we associated with America. And when I moved here in 1980, America has fulfilled all my dreams. So I see, you know, why this is this incredible country that has taken people wherever they came from and has made it possible for them to build their lives.
It's kind
and
of shocking. You
changing.
Talk third world. It is changing. I mean, about the same time, you first came to this country when you were 16, I think,
on a high school exchange. Yes, exactly.
Somewhere in that window. I was about the same age and spent a year in India. At that time, India had not begun its big economic rise. It was incredibly poor. And I always thought, thank heavens I'm an American, because
yes.
in America, even if you sort of fall off, you know, some perch at the top, you can rise up again. There's a middle class and the bottom is not so low. And today, I don't feel that same confidence.
No, and you know, there are statistics that prove your feeling. You know, now you have the bottom 5th percent has a 7% chance of getting to the top 5th percent.
Worse than Europe, worse than chances in Europe.
Much worse.
That's not supposed to be the American
That's
way.
That's exactly. And all, now the basically the promise of being an American or being in America has always been that having a better life is not a game of chance. Now it's become a game of chance. You know, if you're lucky,
or a game of privilege, a game of birth.
Or a privilege, exactly. And now 100 million people make less in real income than their parents did at a similar age.
And the top 1%, something like what, 20, 25% of wealth, income, I don't know. Rhode Island, Johnston, Rhode Island. Denise, you're on the air with Arianna Huffington.
Yes, hi, Arianna.
Hi.
Thanks for taking this call. It's been great listening to you. And like you, I came to this country. I actually came in the mid-80s. I came over from England for school. I was born and raised in England from parents of the Caribbean. And I stayed in this country after school because, like everyone else, all of us immigrants that come here, we wanted to pursue the American dream. And for the most part, I have achieved that. But now I'm very saddened by all the things that I see going on in this country. First, we no longer have a middle class because it's shrank almost to nothing. And that's very worrying. And then the second thing that really bothers me is the way many politicians play upon the fears of people to divide this country. I have a biracial daughter, and I'm really worried about this culture, her, you know, being raised in this culture of hate and prejudice and all the things that's happening now.
Well, you know, there is a lot of concern at the moment, and if you're alluding, for example, to the anti-Muslim fervor around the mosque, I'm very concerned about that.
Islamic Center.
Yes, the Islamic Center, not the Ground Zero Mosque. Language matters, I agree, Tom. But the point here is that I went back and looked at what happened when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, right? Mm-hmm. If you had taken a poll in Montgomery, Alabama at the time, you would probably have the overwhelming majority against what she did, right? You would probably have
they
more
would
than,
not be supporting her
more than 71%. Mm-hmm. Now we're hearing this number as though this means we just cannot let this center be built because 71% of Americans are opposed to it. So what if we had people saying, you know, 71% of Americans in Montgomery, Alabama are opposing Rosa Parks' action, therefore we should not go along with it.
But Denise is pointing, and it's related to this, but to where does the unhappiness, anger, outrage over what you're describing, where does it go? And it can go in many directions.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It can either go against Muslims, against immigrants, against each other, or it can be channeled towards helping each other turn things around. There are only two ways it can go. It can either go in the most destructive channel, or it can go in the most constructive one. There is no halfway.
Denise, thanks for your call. We'll look at the solutions you're calling for, Ariana. A call from Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. For Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for letting me have my say. We should just repeal the Emancipation Proclamation. Instead of renting our slaves from China, we could import our slaves from China. But that's not why I'm calling. I love your the Huffington Post. I think it's great. But after watching you, Ariane, and I think you're a great intellectual, but years of being a conservative, I can't help looking at the messenger as like a P.T. Barnum. You know, like Glenn Beck from Connecticut, and he lives in Greenwich, a really rich, rich area. He has that P.T. Barnum sort of selling the populace what they want to have.
What, you can't forgive Ariana for having been conservative before, or you don't believe that she's turned around now? Or what, Stephen?
No, I think it's just kind of like, you know, P.T. Barnum knew what was coming up, and, you know, I have no, you know, if you're great at sales, sell.
Whatever sells?
Yeah, whatever sells, like a P.T. Barnum, you know?
Well, Ariana, what do you say? I mean, people do look at you. You were there with Contract for America and Newt Gingrich. That was a different time, but you were there. How do you explain where you are now vis-a-vis that?
Oh, I think that it's really easy. I've written and said a lot about it. I think it's very important for people to reevaluate their views. I mean, I was always a social moderate on issues like abortion, gay rights, gun control. My view of my understanding of the role of government dramatically changed in the 1990s when I saw that we could not just do all the things we had to do in terms of solving our problems, our economic problems, our social problems, without the raw power of government appropriations. At the same time, and that has been consistent, I don't believe we can just delegate everything to government and say we don't have to do anything ourselves. That's why in this book, for me, it's a combination of what government can do and what we can do.
So give us a sense of the solutions that you're outlining here, that you're suggesting here.
Well, they're all the political solutions, which range from public financing of campaigns to a real jobs program that includes everything, throwing everything against the wall the way we did when we really wanted to make sure that Wall Street did not collapse.
And kind of get up and get loud message in here, whether it's online or however.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then they're all the personal solutions, which start with something which is not political. The first step I'm recommending is tap into your own resilience. We all have inner strength. If we don't tap into it, we may collapse when things go bad, when we lose jobs, when we lose a home, when we go bankrupt. And yet there are thousands who don't collapse. And I have a lot of those stories in the book, people who manage to turn things around for themselves and for others. And the second point is build your own financial literacy. Stop believing that mortgage companies and credit card companies have your best interests at heart. They don't. Just read the small print. Learn what you need to do. Don't be taken in. The third thing is, what are you doing for others? Because we're seeing again and again that the people who are helping others in some form or another are also empowering themselves.
But over the weekend, I mean, what are people supposed to do when it comes just to politics? You know, over the weekend you were talking about how maybe the vote is none of the above in the midterms coming up. Is that what you're suggesting?
What I'm saying is that in Nevada, which is the only state that has none of the above, it can make a difference to the result, because right now we have this strange situation where the anger at what is happening is affecting Democrats because they're in charge. They're in charge of both the House and the Senate and the White House. But the people who are going to be the beneficiaries of this anger, the Republicans, have policies which are going to make things even worse. So basically, the people are being given a choice between inadequate policies from the Democrats and laughable policies from the Republicans.
So what's your advice to people going into booths in November?
Well, obviously, my advice is that to choose Republicans is simply going to make things infinitely worse because they have no solutions beyond tax cuts. I mean, that literally is their Republican solution. And there's no way that any serious economist, and I'm glad I studied economics, can say that just by cutting taxes, we are going to be able to revive the economy.
How much time does this country have to find its feet to avoid the third world fate that you are outlining here?
I don't know how much time we have, but I know that we cannot waste a second and that we need to continue right away the efforts that are happening around the country. We need to basically scale them up. And that's why I'm putting the spotlight on them. And I would love to invite your listeners to come to Third World America section on the Huffington Post, share their stories, share their solutions, and create a hub around which needs to be done.
Some people are feeling so beaten down, they're giving up. How about you?
Well, that's really the problem. I'm actually feeling more optimistic than I felt when I started writing this book because I saw extraordinary acts of resilience, compassion, and creativity all around the country.
Arianna Huffington is with us. Her new book is Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. She's co-founder and editor of the Huffington Post. Arianna Huffington, welcome back. It's great to have you again, and thanks very much for being here
with us
today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Great to have you. Listeners, thanks for your thoughts and calls today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.